All right, hey, good morning. Welcome back. This is the I Am Sorry About Last Night podcast, part of the Social Podcast Network, www.socialpodcastnetwork.com. Local folks doing local podcasts. Good morning. December the 24th, 2025. It is Christmas Eve, everybody. Hope everyone's having a great holiday. I'm having a terrific time. At least as of today, I am off. I've been very busy at work, but you know what? It's fine. Those are my best days, my work days. So, but I'm off today, hanging out with the family. The boys aren't around. They won't be back till after Christmas, unfortunately. But, you know, that's what called negotiations. And actually, my oldest son, he just does whatever he wants to do. He decided he wanted to spend his Christmas this year with his mom, and I thought that was just fine. And then, of course, my middle son, we go back and forth. But, you know, we're both open, and we, you know, I know that he'll spend his time with his mom, and then she's like, you can come pick him up afterwards. And I'm like, yeah, no, it's fine. We'll get it. We'll get it all taken care of. But it is Christmas. I'm very excited, and it is, well, I celebrated my anniversary. I don't know if I did a podcast since that, but I celebrated my anniversary, 17 years on the 22nd, 17 years of continuous sobriety from drugs and alcohol, and it's pretty cool. I'm going to celebrate tonight. My home group is tonight. And I did go to a meeting. I may have talked about this. I did go to a meeting on Monday. And this little lady, Marianne, gave me a coin. I was so happy. She's such a nice little lady. And so I got my coin, but I'm going to go tonight and speak at the meeting. And then my sponsor, I think, is going to give me probably some cool ceramic coin or something, you know, with some, you know, next level pocket piece. I love that story in the book where it talks about a nice pocket piece. Well, I'm going to get my pocket piece tonight. 17 years, I said to somebody the other day. I waited 17 years to say that. And but you know, it's funny. I sit back today and I'm like, yeah, it's just another day. I'm still amazed that I've been sober for 17 years, right? I mean, 17 years ago was the last time I used pain pills. And I've shared about that in this podcast. I haven't had a drink since 06. But, you know, like my sponsor said, you're going to have to change your sobriety date because of the pain pills. And I was like, well, are you sure? And he's like, well, you do whatever you want to do. But he said, if you do not change it, you will not find serenity. And I was like, all right, I don't even know if I did it because of that. But today I completely understand that. I would hate to be sitting here saying, you know, I got 19 years, but in the back of my head knowing that I was beating the hell out of some pain pills, and but I never discussed it, right? Or I never disclosed that. And so one of the things 17 years later is I think that the most important thing for me today is complete honesty, really. You know, you got to tell everything because it'll wear on me. And that's just not how my life is set up today. Prior to getting sober, I was just a guy that didn't care. I ran my life that way. The people around me probably felt that from me, because how can a person that loves you, right, make the decisions that I used to make? And you know, I've come a long way, and I'm super grateful, and I'm you know, I don't live in fear anymore. I didn't come for that though, right? That wasn't something I was expecting, the big divulgence of fear, but you know, it turns out that's what it is. And you know, I'm just really grateful. It's been, you know, it's been a great 17 years, but it's been a great, you know, year. It's been a great day, right? It's all, you know, it's all been amazing.
Tall, could have used a few pounds. Tight pants, points, hollering out. She was a black-haired beauty with big dark eyes and points all her own, sitting way up high. Way up firm and high. Out past the cornfields where the woods got heavy. Out in the back seat of my 60 Chevy, working on mysteries without any clues. Working on our night moves, trying to make some front page driving news. working on a nine moon. In the summertime. Some pie in the sky summit. We were just young and restless and bored, living by the sword. And we'd steal away every chance we could, to the back room, to the alley, or the trusty woods. I used her, she used me, but neither one cared. We were getting our share, working on a nine moon. Trying to lose a awkward teenage blues.
Awkward teenage blues. I definitely suffered from that. But yeah, Bob Seger, Night Moves, classic. Reminds me of my buddy Billy's mom. She was a big Bob Seger fan, and I remember my buddy Billy and his brother, my brother, trying to... I remember his mom smoked weed, and we were like, oh, man, that's cool. And her boyfriend, he was awesome. And they rode motorcycles. They were from that, like, you know, 60s and 70s sort of vibe. You know, choppers and, you know, living out in New Mexico. And just a different style. But I remember them smoking weed. And I think we stole some of their weed and smoked it. But it was probably our first introduction to weed. But weed was a lot different back then, that's for sure. It was like the you know, this mysterious thing. And but she was a great lady. And she loved her some Bob Seger. So she's passed. Luckily, my wife and I went and visited them back in New Mexico prior to the pandemic, and we got to hang out with her. And so, but yeah, you know, I guess this time of year, it's just about reflection. And, you know, I guess it's always really reflecting on what I'm going to share when I have to speak or when I get to speak, which is tonight. And of course, I go through a lot of different stories and ways that I tell it. And, you know, but the reality is it's, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, my story is a little interesting because I, you know, and I've said this before, you know, my parents were always such, they always took care of my brother and I. They, it, you know, and I don't blame them. I don't know if I would do it the same way if I was raising kids like me. I always say I'd just throw my ass out. It would have probably been the best thing for me to get my shit together, but they were just always just stuck by us. And, you know, with always, of course, with us telling them, we're going to be different. It's going to be, I'm going to change, right? It was one lie, one story, one piece of time. And usually at the end, it was, you know, capped off with, you know, the big realization that I was lying the whole time. And, you know, and so over time, right, my parents got sick of it, but they always stuck by us. So it sort of allowed me to continue to be and live and act and not care the way that I did for a long time. I don't know exactly when I got sober in 97. I feel like I maybe had my first drink. I know that I really got into drinking in 10th grade. So I must have been 14, 15, 16, 15, maybe 15 years old, 16, 15, 16. And, it's like probably 1985, right? I remember I met a couple guys and they really liked to party, and I never had drank Jack or Evan Williams every weekend, right? I'd never bought a 30 pack of beer. I had never played quarters, right? This was my real introduction to partying, and I think I was in 10th grade. So, you know, I don't know if I've been sober longer than I drank. But I can tell you back in 10th grade when I drank, I didn't drink every day, right? I drank on the weekends. I might drink on one of the weekend days and then, you know, probably recovered the rest of the weekend. But it wasn't like the way that I drank in the end. And it wasn't about not caring. Of course, there were other things, and I've shared before that, you know, because really I have a decision-making problem, really. The decision-making problem eventually would lead me to where it led me, to the point where I'd eventually get sober. It wasn't my drinking problem because, you know, I made bad decisions every day. I did not drink every day. I didn't do drugs every day. You know, my biggest pushback in life early on was ditching school, right? Girls were my first addiction, my first girlfriend. I mean, I've completely went into the woods with that. I mean, I was like, I couldn't hear or see anything. All I saw was her. It was the most important thing. I thought it was freaking the greatest thing since sliced bread, right? And, you know, we did school and we snuck into houses and we, you know, we were in our own world, right? Kind of like that song, Night Moves. But I hadn't even started drinking, right? But I started making choices because I didn't care. I cared more about that relationship. I cared more about her than I cared about the repercussions of my decisions, meaning what my parents were going to think. And so that was my first introduction. You know, maybe it was a problem. It was an inconvenience back then for my parents. And, you know, there was a few dust-ups about it. But then later on, you know, sort of living in that style of living, which is I don't care. And, you know, eventually meeting my friends and starting to drink, right? But I was still home by 11, right? I just snuck in a little quieter, right? Came in. I did care to a certain point. I always wanted to drink, or, you know, back early on, it was really about smoking pot for me. You know, we may drink a little bit, but shit, every day was really trying to find weed. And we would find it, and I would come home at 11, and sometimes we would get Visine, right? Or sometimes we wouldn't, and, you know, it was already sort of a, you know, a dark part of our household because my dad and mom hated the weed and they knew that I started smoking it. And so that was our first real battle. But I remember I was always, you know, I didn't care enough to not to say no to smoking it, but I did care enough to be home on time. Right. Right. I followed most of the rules, right? It was that last 5% is that I broke. But, you know, I would be home on time. We'd, you know, take care of the car. We'd do our chores. You know, I still cared. But I would start not caring just about a few things. But that would be the beginning, right? That would be the beginning. And my darkest point in my life probably was San Diego, you know, because I had, you know, I'd been in New Mexico smoking and had started drinking. And then I had started messing around a little bit with some methamphetamines. There was some people showing up around Albuquerque with some drugs. And I remember a guy, you know, we did them, tried them. I was like, that's great. And I was like, I might have a friend that wants some. He gave me like, I don't know, an 8-ball of it. He's like, sell it. I'm like, all right. We didn't. We did it. And he came and knocking for his money, kicked in my front door of our apartment, grabbed me by my collar. I thought he was going to beat the shit out of me. And he, you know, he definitely put the fear into me. But that was my first introduction into that life of crime and drugs and all the shit that comes along with it. And then eventually, you know, still trying to hold it together in New Mexico. My parents had by then had moved to California. I had stayed in New Mexico trying to keep a relationship. And none of that was working. So I finally packed up my car and ended up out in San Diego. And you know, but that would be the beginning of really a dark period in my life, which was methamphetamines. You know, we started partying. Oh, my God. And early on, it was, you know, it was just, I think it was just crank. But for some reason, there was a period of time there when all of a sudden this amazing drug started showing up, you know, like you see in Breaking Bad. And they figured out something, how to smoke it. And man, we were all on board and started selling it. And people coming from Florida to buy ounces of this shit. And it was just, you know, we stayed up all night and stayed up all day. I mean, there were times I think probably stayed up multiple days and we had a lot of fun. Unfortunately, you know, I don't know why I didn't like completely lose my shit while I was on that stuff, like I've seen many people do, but for some reason I sort of held it together and had a great group of friends and we had a lot of fun and we partied and we sold it and we made a lot of money and did all that stuff. And then, you know, of course the end, you know, and by then, you know, early on in California, living with my parents, drinking my mom's wine, doing drugs, staying up all night, and then finally having it out with my dad and ending up in a rehab. Stayed there for a month and then decided to move in with a girl. And that was the beginning of me leaving the parents' house. And her and I lived together. And then eventually we broke up and then my dad had to come forth with a little money to help me get my one-bedroom apartment down in Encinitas. And it was freaking great, man. I loved it. I loved it. And I wouldn't have been able to do any of that, though, if it wasn't for the support of my parents. And so once again, I was able to continue what I was doing, continue the lies, continue the behavior. And I'm not blaming them, but, You know, I used my parents, and it's a shame. You know, it was a big amends I had to make to them. Still do. I still continue making amends to my father about that. But, you know, haven't living that life. And then finally, you know, the law coming in, kicking in the door. I had my first, you know, I had my brief experience with the law. One morning, I hear all this racket down the hall. I look out my door, and the, you know, San Diego police are basically kicking in my neighbor's door. And I was looking down the hall, and they look at me, and they're like, "Hey!" I'm like, "Oh, shit." And they come running down. They're like, you got any drugs in here?" I'm like, "No." And, of course, I had meth. I had weed. I had everything in there. And he goes, I go, "No, I don't have any drugs." And he's like, "Well, we're going to search your house. If you have any cocaine, you're going to jail. If you have anything..." He goes, "If you let us search your house for cocaine and we don't find any cocaine, we won't do anything. But if we find cocaine, you're going to jail." And I was like, I go, "Well, search my house then." And, you know, they did, and I had no cocaine, but they did find the meth, and they found the weed and the bongs and the, you know, all the paraphernalia and the torches and the glassware and all this shit. And they took it all, and they said, "Hey, I told you we weren't going to arrest you." And they didn't. They walked out with all my stuff, and so that was my first real scrape with the law. You would think at that moment I'd be like, "Okay, let's make an adjustment." But no, we didn't do it. In fact, I probably was like, "Yeah, these guys don't care about me." And honestly, they didn't until the minute that they did. And then all of a sudden, one night, there's a knock at the door, and I open it, and it's some guy with a clipboard. And he's like, "Do you know anything about..." And then all of a sudden, all these cops rush in my front door, and I was like, "Oh, shit." And I got busted. And I've shared about that, you know, in this podcast many a times, right? You know, the demons were so... I was living the dark life. I was possessed by demons, self, right, and all that stuff. And, you know, I couldn't kick that monkey, man. You know, I get arrested. You would think that would be an awakening, but no, I continued to use. I'm so freaking lucky, because I tell you, I saw so many people get caught up in the system in San Diego. And, you know, they get busted, they go to jail, they come out, they go to court, they're a fourth waiver, and then they're just, you know, constantly being popped. They can't get out of the system. You know, when you're a fourth waiver, you waive your right to privacy. And so that means that they can stop you, and they can search you and anybody that's with you and in the car that's with them. If you have a fourth waiver in your car, they can still search your car. So it's a nightmare. And so many of my friends kept getting caught up in this loop, and I was headed there. I was absolutely headed there, because I can tell you, I got home from, you know, going to jail when I was initially arrested, and I got high, you know, and I continued to get high, smoking weed, smoking meth, drinking booze, until, you know, my first court appearance. And I was like, I can't go to court high. Who went to court high? I did. That's how freaking bad it was. And that's, you know why? I just did not give a fuck. Or I would tell myself I did, but I just couldn't stop. Went to court high. You know, of course, my father paid for a great attorney, because I got busted with a gun. You know, I had a gun. People, "Oh my God, you had a gun." Well, actually, I traded some meth for a fucking shotgun. I didn't even probably know how to load the fucking thing, but it was in my bedroom closet, and the cops found it. And so, of course, they had added that charge on. Violent criminal, and it changed everything, really. I mean, thank God for the gun. Let's put it that way, because had I not had that gun, I probably would have gone to work release, and I probably would have gotten high, and I probably would have made it even 10 times worse. So, but, you know, I have to be accountable, right? I'm willing to really take a look at that and realize, man, you know, as much as I fucking hated the fact that I had that gun and hated the fact that the person that gave it to me, today I can look back and say, you know, the gun probably saved me, you know, more pain, because, I don't know. But, you know, going to court, still high, and then finally being sentenced, going, I'm like, I can't turn myself in high. Sure as fucking, I didn't. I went right to fucking work release high. Could not stop. And then, of course, off to jail, and, you know, 101 days in a work camp in Big Bear Mountain. And, you know, meetings every day in jail, and just, you know, changing my ways. Get out of jail, and I got high, right? And, you know, so really the point of the story is that my parents, you know, of course, my dad's like, you know, get a U-Haul, move the hell out of there. If my dad wouldn't help me, I'd still be there, right? I'd still be stuck in California. But I loaded up, smoked meth across the United States, ended up here in Delaware. And that's really where my drinking began because, you know, I just swapped the meth for alcohol. And with this righteous attitude that alcohol is legal and I can do it. I can drink it. It's legal. Because up until this point, everything I'd loved so much was so illegal. It was like almost a relief that I could finally just drink alcohol without catching a lot of grief. I could, you know, drink my mom's wine. I could drink my dad's beer. You know, we almost had something in common for the first time, right? And but that's where the drinking would really fire up. And, you know, I had this job working at a shortstop and I had the midnight shift and I would get off at 7 and I would drink because my arrogant ass is like, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. And I was going deeper and deeper and deeper and darker and finally ended up in that one-bedroom apartment drinking a full bottle of vodka every night and just pretty much saying, this is my life today. And never, ever, ever being serious about getting sober. And then March 31st, 1997, getting into that fight and, you know, ending up saying yes to treatment, ending up at the hospital. And it was just the 5 days that I needed, right? Had I not been punched in the mouth, had there not been an open wound, had I not needed stitches, I don't know if I'd be here again. Right, but they said, do you think you have a problem? And I said, I did, and they admitted me. And I was up in the hospital for 5 days, and that's when AA came up and found me up there. And they said, do you want to go to a meeting? And I said, yes, I do. And, you know, because the shame, I had been punched, I had been humiliated, I had been embarrassed, and the ego had left. You know, complete humiliation, ego devastation. And that small window had opened, and AA was right there when it did. And I said, yes, and that would be, you know, the beginning of an amazing journey. I would not stay sober from that day. I've shared before I drank after 4 years, but personally, I think I needed it. It really changed my perspective on recovery. But, you know, it's just been an amazing trip. And, you know, the one thing that I will say that meeting makers do make it, I don't see many people that make a lot of meetings that don't make it. It's usually the first thing that starts to drop off. And even when I drank after 4 years, you know, I had talked myself into believing that the meetings that I were going to weren't very good and that I should find others. And once I did that, you know, the addiction, the spirit, the devil really knew in the back of its head that we had no intention of finding another meeting, and we never did. And then eventually I was like, you know, I've been thinking about drinking, and next thing you know, I'm drinking. And here we go, because after that, I could not stop again. And so 4 years, and then, of course, you know, 2006, finally, you know, I shared in a meeting the other day, you know, the first time I got sober was through the hospital. The second time I got sober was through divorce. And the third time I got sober was because of pain pills. But what I learned the first time and the second time and the third time, you know, I took all of that into my third try. And, you know, it's just, I remember, you know, first few years of my, you know, of this stint of sobriety, you know, I didn't want any coins. I didn't want to, you know, I was embarrassed. I didn't want to play that part. It wasn't important this time, right? That's what I'd say. Coins aren't important this time. They are important, you know, because it lets other people realize that if we try and we put the time together, we can get a coin, right? It's a big deal to people that haven't ever had a coin. You see a lot of people get that first year coin and they fade off. It's like the big number one coin and you know, it can make a few people drop off. So, but it's been an amazing journey. I am, you know, I said this before, I'm not here today because I don't want to drink. I'm here because I love the relationship I have with God, higher power. See, to me, higher power is qualification, right? It's merit. You know, it's this, you know, what sort of baggage do I carry? And if one of them is that I've been through a 12-step program, rigorously, honestly have gone through it and worked it and continue to find sobriety and serenity, I find that a value. So higher power, but a God of my understanding. You know, one of the coolest things that I think that have happened to me in this 17 years is having an understanding of what God is for me today. And what that is just peace, love, and free of fear. You know, my buddy Matt used to say, I am not afraid and I am not a victim. And I'm like, this guy's at another level. Well, I get it today. I'm not afraid and I am not a victim. You know, when I lay in bed at night, I have nothing to think about. I'm like, let's imagine flying through trees, right? Let's imagine the sun. Let's imagine, you know, how come my mind isn't like able to speak with people telepathy, you know, through telepathy? You know, I'm like, I'm making shit up to think about. But when I was back in my drinking days, I don't even know if I thought of anything. I probably just passed out. But, you know, early teens, you know, ditching school, finding weed, you know, I was just tortured by all of my bad behavior. You know, when's my dad going to find out? How many days until, we have to take the P test? You know, when's my grades coming out? It was just, oh, my God, the fucking burden. Oh, ugh. I don't have that today. You know, and if I, and, you know, the program has taught me, you know, I use the 10th step, you know, I use the meditation part to really plan out my day and my week and my life. You know, I try to find the parts that are going to be tough and then I get a plan how to handle it. You know, I don't want to become arrogant, right? I don't want inconvenience to show up. And turns out after all is said and done and all of the work, my biggest problem is that inconvenience. Inconvenience is everywhere. And the, you know, I know what it's like. I, you know, to me, they're spirits, it's reality. But I see people all around me that are not working programs. Maybe they don't need a program, right? Maybe they're not using alcohol or drugs. They just live in life. But all of their biggest problems are inconveniences. I hear about it all day from my clients. So and so did this, and the traffic did this, and this is this, and you know, and it's always the inconvenience, which brings out the arrogance, and then we say and do things in a way that we typically wouldn't do it. It happens to all of us. It's everywhere, and you know, that for a guy like me could possibly lead me back to a drink, right? Oh, this happens. Oh, fuck it. Let's just drink. Right. That's one of the cool things I was telling. I think I don't know if I shared this, but I started sponsoring a new guy the other day on Wednesday. No, on Monday. Excuse me. Monday, there was a guy there with his mom, you know, bottom of the story. And I offered to be a sponsor, and he's been calling. And, but the, what was my point about that? I don't know. I don't know. It's just been a great, I got a lot going on in my head. It's been inconvenience. But it's, you know, it's the biggest problem I have today in my life. And I really try to avoid having that happen. And so what I end up with is really just living a life, peace, love, and free of fear. And it's pretty freaking good. And, so I'm going to go tonight. I'm going to celebrate. I'm going to get my shiny coin. I love the coin that Mary Ann gave me. It was one of them old, dirty, you know, rusty, rugged coins. And so I'll get the cool one today. All right, let me read the daily reflections, and then I'm going to get out of here. Let's see. December the 24th, a sane and happy usefulness. All right. We have come to believe he would like us to keep our heads in the clouds with him, but that our feet ought to be firmly planted on the earth. That is where our fellow travelers are, and that is where our work must be done. These are the realities for us. We have found nothing incompatible between a powerful spiritual experience and a life of sane and happy usefulness. Alcoholics Anonymous, page 130. All the prayer and meditation in the world will not help me unless they are accompanied by action. Practicing the principles in all my affairs shows me the care that God takes in all parts of my life. God appears in my world when I move aside and allow him to step into it. Yep. God appears in my world when I move aside, when self moves aside. Doesn't say that, but yeah, you know, and that's the other thing. And I may have said this, you know, that third step, that was what we talked about the other day. And, you know, it talks about turning our will, our thinking, and our lives, our actions over to the care of a God of our understanding. You know, it sort of makes you reflect back on the first step where it says we admit we're powerless over our alcohol, that our lives really means actions. Our actions are unmanageable. And then I start realizing that I don't even know what life is, right? I don't even, you know, because to me, a life with fear and victimy and, you know, self-centeredness is no life. And thank God I don't have to live like that. All right, listen, thank you. Have a great day, and I will catch you later. Bye. Working on a nine
the lightning, yeah. Waited on the thunder, waited on the thunder. I woke last night to the sound of thunder. How far off, I sat and wondered. Started humming a song from 1962. And funny how the night moves when you just don't seem to have as much to lose. Strange how the night moves with autumn closing in.